I'm Sai. Morning, everyone. I'm from the SBQR lab headed by Kevin. And this is some work that I've been doing with another PhD student at our lab, Amir, and Professors Peter Honeyman, who's in the back, and Kevin. So the sort of area that we're interested in is malware in the clinical domain, because it's becoming a more and more critical issue, if it's not already. And we know that medical devices are vulnerable to malware. And we know this because we've seen this in the regulatory sphere. For instance, the FDA recently sent out a cybersecurity draft guidance letting manufacturers know that they need to focus on security. We've seen this in academia in certain papers. And we've also seen this in mass media. And the problem is that, you know, one of the things we can think about is why are medical devices vulnerable in the first place? And it comes down to the fact that these are embedded systems, and so their tasks and goals are different from the workstations and stuff that we see regularly. And they end up, you know, many times they end up having outdated operating systems or outdated software, and manufacturers are sort of reluctant to upgrade or patch these systems. A, because I think they're really like Newton's first law, so very inertia-minded. And also, they sort of have this erroneous assumption that if they want to patch systems, they have to get FDA approval again and things like that. So they sort of use that as a way to make sure that they don't have to go around patching these devices. So the onus of protecting these devices falls on the IT systems in the hospitals. And they use certain techniques, so they use things called isolated networks, where they put these medical devices behind networks so that connections can't go in or out. They're in their own separate sphere. They also use things like virtual LANs, which work in a similar way. They partition networks into multiple distinct domains so that the only way they can talk to each other is to go through routers. And they use things called access control lists, which is basically a list that has a bunch of IP addresses on there, which are machine IP addresses, that say, hey, am I allowed to have internet access or not? So one thing we need to sort of figure out first is to characterize the clinical domain that we're situated in. So right now, manufacturers, the major focus for them is safety, which makes sense. You don't want to harm the patient with these devices. You want to provide care. But the problem is that if you sort of forget about security, you're leaving these gaping holes that can be taken advantage by adversaries, and they could end up harming patients, even if you are, you know, completely safety-minded. So what we're trying to do is think about a proactive way of looking at security and sort of preclude adversaries from taking advantage of these security flaws. So one of the first, one of the major questions that we're interested in identifying is what the major, or the dominant vectors for malware infections are. So here you can see sort of a attack surface that we sort of devised, where you have the broad internet here. And then there's multiple ways that a medical device, which is sitting over here, could get compromised. If it's directly connected to the internet, then, you know, there's a vector right there. Or if the doctor is at home, plugs in a USB device, let's say it's at home, brings their own device into the hospital network, and then uses a infected USB device to plug it into the medical device, then the medical device would end up with malware on it, even if it's not directly connected to the internet. So there's multiple vectors. We're sort of trying to figure out what the dominant ones are. And then once we do so, we try to figure out how to mitigate these vectors as well. And so to address these, we need to know how to detect infections, right, figure out malware. Then we need to quantify this, so try to figure out what the infection rates are over time, or just look at raw numbers for these infections. And finally, we can then qualify the type of malware infection. So are these viruses, are these botnets, those sort of classification of malware. And for the work that we've been trying to do, we focus on detection. So our hypothesis is that we can detect compromised medical devices using the network perspective. And by network perspective, we mean that we can use network data to try to, you know, fingerprint malware. And this data that we use three different data sets. We use something called a dark net, which is also known as a network telescope. This is basically an address space that's unused. So any traffic that gets there is probably suspicious. We also use something called NetFlow, which gives us metadata about connections. So things like source IP, destination IP, source port, destination port, connection timings, things like that. No packets. This is just surface surface info. And then we finally use a blacklist. And this contains a list of IP addresses that have that are maybe spam hosts, command and control servers, things like that. The bad guys on the internet. Potentially bad guys on the internet. So the problem, though, is that because we are in the healthcare sphere, we can't just go and look at the packets that are going on the internet in the hospital and say, hey, what are you doing? What are you doing? Because of HIPAA concerns and privacy issues and things like that. So it'd be really easy if we could, because we could just look at the packets and say, aha, you're going to a bad place. You should stop doing that. So that's how we have to use sort of these surface level data sets. And the other problem is that the hospital with whom we collaborate, this is sort of their network architecture diagram. And I can see at the top is where the internet is. And then at the bottom are where the medical devices are. And some of them are directly connected to the internet through a couple of hoops. But some of them are in these isolated networks. And if you can sort of remember what I said in the beginning, one of the techniques that IT departments use in hospitals is to put medical devices behind isolated networks, saying, like, well, if they can't get in or out, they, you know, they're probably not going to get infected. So with this data, we sort of devised a couple of experiments. The overarching theme of all these experiments is to look through this network data and then try to fingerprint malware and then zero in on these devices. So the first sort of there are three experiments that we came up with, so using the various three data sets. And for the darknet, it was basically a matter of trying to figure out within the packets that we receive which of the source IP addresses came from the hospital's address space. With the NetFlow, we tried to use a couple of different heuristics. And by heuristics, we mean things like what machines are or what workstations are doing things like port scanning, because port scanning is a hallmark of worms. Things like odd port behavior. For instance, if there's a machine that is pretending to be a DNS server or a mail server, but it's clearly not, then it's probably been compromised. And look for things that like that behave like botnets. So if they're doing port scanning after having received instructions from a known command and control server. And we also did something called what we call timing analysis, which is basically look at the connection and lengths between packets. And we hypothesized that if something is part of a botnet, then it would exhibit unusually periodic timing. And so by looking at things like the average connection time and then the standard deviation and things like that, we could come up with the coefficient of variance. And then the ones that are really low are probably indicative of something strange going on. So after all the experiments, this is sort of our diagnosis. Unfortunately, the darknet has been of little use. It seems that the trend in malware these days, all the cool kids are doing drive-by downloads. They're not really doing the sort of scanning behavior anymore. So we ended up with about 12 packets in this darknet data among millions upon millions of packets. And all but one of this these packets were BitTorrent packets. So that was kind of not very helpful. And in terms of the experiment, too, this is just looking at heuristics in the NetFlow. We saw some anomalous behavior. So we noticed at least two workstations in the radiology department that seemed to be infected with adware. There were a couple of hosts that were operating over the Bitcoin port. And keep in mind, this is inside a hospital. There was a machine that was contacting a Tor exit node, I think in Romania, over the IRC channel port, which is probably not something normal machines are supposed to do. And the one of the neat things that we found is that some of our experiments were mutually reinforcing. So for instance, the last one is that we were looking for machines that were contacting the addresses in the blacklist. And so this the machine that was on the IRC port showed up in both the experiments because it was contacting this weird server in Romania, but it also exhibited really, really low coefficient of variance in the timing analysis. So this is sort of a histogram of the coefficient of variances for various machines in the radiology. These are machines inside the hospital that are contacting external IP addresses. And the ones that are on the complete low end warrant further attention because they're really far away from the mean network connection times. And then finally, the sort of graph thing here
machines in the radiology department that were talking to external eyepiece. And just from doing a plot like this, you can see that there are a bunch of these. So radiology has workstations that involve, like, do things with x-ray images and things like that. They're talking to a lot of external eyepieces that are on the blacklist. So this is probably a telltale sign that some of them were at least compromised. So a deeper look into these machines is currently taking place. But unfortunately, we have yet to find a smoking gun. We have yet to find a machine that's like, aha, you're clearly infected with malware, blah, blah. Right? So when it comes to our evaluation, we know that devices are vulnerable, again, because of what the FDA said, of, you know, sort of these popular media reports and academic literature. And we know that hospital networks have malware. You just go talk to an IT department and they'll let you know. But then, you know, we're sort of thinking about why we aren't seeing these gotcha signs yet. And potential reasons why are sort of the recommendations that I mentioned in the subtitle of this title slide. So the first thing is that we believe that these network traces that we're gathering either need to be targeted for specific events or they need to be longitudinal in nature. And by longitudinal, we just mean that they need to have be gathered over a long period of time. The NetFlow that we gathered were 24-hour traces. So this is a day's worth of data. And the problem is that if you have things like, let's say, the Conficker worm that came out, you know, 5, 7, 8 years ago or so, if you're just getting a day's worth of data, you're probably going to be missing it. So this is sort of trying to cover your bases and casting as wide a net as you can so that if events do come about, you'll have a better chance of capturing them. And also, there were other studies that were done, for instance, by the Department of Veterans Affairs that looked at these sort of issues over a three-year period. And they had this nice longitudinal data set, and they were able to glean some good info from it. The other thing is that it seems that effective network administration is a very potent means of limiting both the scope and the number of these malware incidents. For instance, just anecdotally, the same hospital with whom we collaborate, this Conficker, when it sort of hit the hospital system, because of their usage of isolated networks and because of their usage of these access control lists and VLANs, didn't really affect their systems as much. But the problem is that the usage of these sort of techniques is not a panacea, because these air gaps can be crossed. All it takes, for instance, is a USB to go from an infected workstation to a medical device. It doesn't matter if the medical device is in an isolated network. It's got malware on it now. And this was sort of corroborated by the Department of Veterans Affairs report. They did a study over three years, and they found that almost 140 of their devices had malware on them, even though they were behind isolated networks. And then finally, sort of last prescription is that device level investigations are pretty important in trying to identify what classes of medical devices are more prone or more susceptible to malware ending up on them. So this is not only productive, but it's also very helpful for academics to know, manufacturers obviously, and then the IT departments themselves, because they have the practical issue of trying to figure out how to protect these things. The pros is that previous research, like I said, has been very useful. And if you do find, let's say, a compounder that can easily be susceptible to malware, you can go up to the manufacturer and say, hey, you know what? It's not just one random device in the hospital that has a problem. It's an entire class of your compounders that has a problem. And so then by learning about device-level vulnerabilities, we can craft better network administrative policies. But the cons are that getting access to devices is notoriously difficult. Unfortunately, it doesn't matter how nice you are. If you go ask manufacturers, hey, can I borrow your device? They really don't let you use it, which sucks. And it can also be sort of slow going, right? Because you have to tear down the entire architecture of this device to try to figure out what the internals are. So that's all I have for you guys. So if you have any questions, let me know.
Okay, and we actually have 5 minutes remaining. So we already have someone approaching the mic, but feel free to step up to get in line if you have any questions for Sai.
Well, I wonder in the medical domain whether the number of applications they use and the network activity can be whitelisted. So can you just have a nice definition of what you expect in the medical device and just to kind of whitelisting approach?
So I think that access control list is sort of tantamount to a whitelist because you have a bunch of workstations that you know need internet access. For instance, there's something called a PACS system, picture archiving something system. And you know that these need internet access because that's how the radiologists sort of send images across the hospital intranet as well. And that's how they sort of create these access control lists, is to put machines that need internet access on it. And then anything else that's not on that list is basically a default to you're not going to be on the wireless. So you're right in that there are certain applications that need internet access, and I think that's what the IT departments take into account with these access control lists. Peter?
Peter Honeyman, University of Michigan. Suppose that you had found a ton of malware-infected medical devices and that you determined that the vector was thumb drives. What kind of protocols would you suggest? What kind of mechanisms would you suggest to fight that vector?
So one thing that I can think of is to have a rule, let's say, in the hospital that says, don't plug in USB devices into medical devices and use a workstation.
Well, that's not hard. I mean, that's hardly realistic, right? I mean,
sure.
They have USB ports for thumb drives to move data around. I mean,
right.
That's the whole idea. So you've just made them dysfunctional instead of fixing them.
So can you use like a intermediary computer that's like a, I don't know, virtual machine or something? You can plug the USB from the medical device into this computer that's so that you can extract the data that you need.
So would you suggest like checklists, those sorts of things? I mean, this is what clinicians use, right? I mean, these have been very effective, as well as hand-washing protocols. I mean, do you think there are analogies there?
Yeah, actually, that hand-washing protocol that you brought about, sort of, I think in one of Kevin's talks, he mentioned how back in the 1800s, doctors wouldn't wash their hands when doing surgeries. And then after a while, because of some pioneering work done, they realized that, hey, we should probably be doing this. So I guess in a similar vein for security, we could try to create certain checklists or protocols that we can tell the physicians or the nurses to say, if you're going to plug in a USB device into a medical device, please do this and this before plugging it into your actual workstation to extract the data, so that we can sort of sterilize that USB device in an intermediate computer and then
plug
it into the
of your future research? I mean, is this stuff you intend to be looking at down the road?
That's a very interesting thing to look at, I think, yeah. Yeah. I might talk to you and Kevin about it.
Oh, and name and affiliation again.
Marcel Simon, J&J. So medical devices at bottom are usually Windows systems heavily modified, or Linux systems heavily modified. So did you do any analysis there's been a fair amount of research and analysis done on malware infection for, non-medical device Windows machines and Linux machines.
Right.
Did you do any comparison as to how malware infection on medical devices differ from plain old laptops or, other endpoints and or are different or are the same?
So I didn't personally do anything, but I think one of the reasons that these medical devices with the Windows systems or the Linux systems, you can't quite put a traditional antivirus solution on there, mm-hmm. is because they've probably been gutted of certain features that these AV solutions need to run.
Right.
So that's one of the problems as well. If these are just regular Windows laptop things with medical sensors on them, it would be pretty straightforward to just put in a antivirus solution on there and let that AV solution take care of everything.
That's right.
But
that's
because you can't do that, a lot of this management falls on the head of IT.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they have to start looking into things like these access control lists and isolated networks and things like that.
So to that, you said finding a couple of systems that are trying to talk Bitcoin or talking BitTorrent, and that, or that you don't consider that a smoking gun for infection. What kind of standards do you have for knowing what?
I wanted a packet that said I am malware.
Dude, you don't find that. That just never happens. I mean, that's a great way to report 0% infection, but you know, not useful otherwise.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to shoot a question back.
Sure.
As a manufacturer, how comfortable are you with having a third-party antivirus software on your device without control over it?
Yeah, that usually doesn't work because the pushback from R&D is that there are some very, very restrictive requirements for turnaround time, whatever that might mean. And anti-malware will slow that down. By any extent, anything more than zero is not acceptable.
Oh, that's so it's not a safety issue.
Correct. Oh. Well, okay. It's a timing turnaround, which then impacts safety because you get incorrect readings or something like that.
So your devices have zero budget for safety.
I did not say that. Absolutely did not say that.
Again, anti-malware software is not designed for systems that have real-time turnaround responses. I ran into that not just at J&J for medical devices, but also if you've got a system that's managing a, an assembly line, okay, where it has to respond when that's the same issue. You're going to have that same problem everywhere.
Why is there no malware? Why is there then no software to do malware detection on these systems? We know these systems are safety critical. We know they get malware. Therefore, we need malware detection for these systems. Where is it? But that's a safety budget, isn't it?
So let me point out, we are only getting this kind of data over the last couple of years. There was, for quite some time, a belief that these systems would not be attacked. Yes, there was. That's just reality. And I very much want to say, having given you a hard time for, you know, believing that a Bitcoin machine is not, you know, smoking gun, this sort of research is good stuff because it says that, no, in fact, medical devices are just as much subject to attack as any other system. And the more they resemble a plain old Windows machine, the more they're going to get attacked and the more they're going to get infected. So my personal belief, and this is my opinion, and I don't speak on behalf of my company, please understand that, is the right thing to do is to shrink the attack surface. Make these machines not look like plain old systems. Make them behave totally differently.
I think you just have a research challenge. Okay,
yes.
David.
I'd like to come back to a future health tech and hear the results.
Me too.
So I think at one point you said, David Coates from Dartmouth College, at one point you said this is the way the IT administrator has to handle setting up these things and protecting the systems. What if there is no IT administrator? I'm thinking of some of the smaller clinics that I've been to or that I work with. There's doctors, there's nurses, there's secretaries. No IT staff. How do they handle these problems?
That's a really good question. And actually, that was one of the things on my discussion question pad, because I think that's an interesting avenue of research. So punchline is that I'm not actually sure, because we feasibly, you know, if you're thinking about it, they probably would have more problems with these sort of malware or compromising sort of events that take place if they don't use these sort of isolated networks or whatever techniques that IT is using. So I think that's a very interesting avenue of research that would, like, especially because small clinics are a big part of the entire healthcare industry.
Okay, well, I think we've run out of time, so we're gonna thanks, Sai, and move on to our next talk.
Thank you.